Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. My name is Rob Farley, and with me today is Dan Nexon, a fellow front pager at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and also Brad DeLong, Dr. Brad DeLong of the University of California, Berkeley. And you are actually in Berkeley
right
now. And
a huge Warren Zevon fan, an absolutely huge Warren Zevon fan. And you owe my attendance to your weblog since its very beginnings to your incredibly inspired choice of title, which I have envied ever since, bitterly. And jealously.
Well, I think that the listeners will have guessed at this point but that we are doing another session of our oral history of the blogosphere. And so it is absolutely my delight to welcome you to the series, and I'm sure Dan feels the same way. Listeners, Dan has a little bit of a scratchy voice, but it shouldn't be a problem. So I guess, Brad, to start off with, let's go back and let's start at the beginning. When did you start blogging and why did you start blogging? Because you're an early adopter and you were also somebody of some consequence before you started blogging, rather than someone like myself who owes the entirety of his fame to blogging.
Well, I suppose in the beginning, it's the spring of 1995. And I am working for the U.S. Treasury as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy. And, you know, the wonderful, wonderful Treasury Secretary, Lord Benson, is replaced by the wonderful, wonderful Treasury Secretary, Bob Rubin, whom I adore, who is very smart, who is an excellent boss. But at the time, I had a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And, you know, Lloyd Benson had been out of the office at 6 p.m. every night to go on his cocktail party and dinner rounds and maintain his Washington, D.C. network. Bob Rubin had left his family and network behind in New York City and then was staying at a hotel 2 blocks away from the Treasury. And, you know, wanted us to all to work Goldman Sachs hours for Goldman Sachs divided by 10 pay scales. And I wanted to see my babies and I wanted to stay married. So we abandoned the Treasury and Berkeley offered to tenure me. And so we came out here to California, to the University of California at Berkeley. And I sat down fresh out of the Treasury, fresh out of 3 years doing policy and trying to figure out what I should do with my academic career now that I was tenured. I had a senior roommate, then a physics professor at Princeton University, Paul Mendy, who said, hey, there's this http://. thing. It's really great. We at physics have already moved all of our real intellectual conversation to httparchive.org. I'm sure economics is going to follow. You should learn how to write HTML, and you should start throwing everything you do in working paper or even pre-working paper format up on this thing called the World Wide Web. And I said, but economics doesn't have an archive.org equivalent. Paul Mendy said, it will very soon. So you should get a jump on it. And so I began handcrafting HTML and putting up files and running them from the machine burbling away at the corner of our bedroom. Economics never got its archive.org. It did get NBER.org, which, because it was a gatekept organization restricted to members, faculty research fellows and research associates, caused, I think, a bunch of long-run problems for economics. But economics never got its archive.org. Nevertheless, I pushed forward. And, you know, come 1998, I was, as one does, picking up my new copy of Foreign Affairs and going upstairs and reading it, not cover to cover, but skimming interesting things, finding two very useful, I thought, and interesting articles by economists, one by Jagdish Bhagwati and one by Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman raved about how great I was. And about how insightful my work on economic growth was. Jagdish Bhagwati denounced me as one of the most pig-headed and short-sighted apologists for global capital mobility. both of them were people whose attention I very much wanted to get at that stage in my career as some of the very senior princes of economics, as, you know, Nobel Prize caliber thinkers. They both are. Paul got his. Jagdish was, I think, cheated of his when they gave the trade award to a different bunch of people who should have gotten it, but that's not there. At any event, I looked at the quotes they had, and the quotes weren't from the published versions. They were from the versions I had thrown up on the web. And I had And I had this image of Jagdish and Paul both under some frantic deadline from Foreign Affairs with the editor yelling at them on the phone, wanting a quote to slot in some place in their argument. And so desperately, there was no Google back then. I think it must have been altavista.dec.com or something, the Digital Equipment Corporation's version. Googling and finding my quote and then slotting it in. And I thought, this looks to be the way to acquire influence in a way that writing things that then get published in academic journals or even in evanescent daily newspapers and then filed in the depths of libraries and in microfilm, you will not, because it will always be at people's fingertips. I thought someone should go all in on this. And Tyler Cohen was thinking the same thing. Alex Tabarrok was thinking the same thing back then. And so we decided to go for it. And indeed, for 20 years, we were correct.
I mean, that's so what makes that story very, very interesting to me is because, and Dan, I'm sure Dan has views on this as well, right? Among political scientists, blogging has long, or back in the day, felt very much like an insurgent affair, right? And it was treated as an insurgent affair, and yes, sort of almost antithetical and almost damaged. And people making straightforwardly the argument that if you blog, this is damaging to your career. And in fact, at one point, my advisor said, you should be really worried about your career, which, you know, okay. And so it seems like the dynamics for you were a lot different than that, though. I mean, you saw this as sort of a way of, you know, not even building up a counterpart to your career as an economist, but as something that sort of very much fit into your long-term career plans.
Certainly university bureaucracies were, and I think are and remain very suspicious of it. You know, university public relations departments are incredibly enthusiastic. But, you know, the background dinosaur bureaucracies of California, hell, and elsewhere are kind of very suspicious, you know, of people doing things that don't slot into the journals in the basement of Doe or, you know, courses taught or particular grants obtained. Within the economics profession, it's been much more, yes, this is a relevant thing you can do. And, you know, once you have tenure, we really ought to have a diversified intellectual portfolio of economists doing different things. So I would say there's a sharp distinction between how university bureaucracies view it and how economists view it. And there's also a sharp distinction between, you know, what you do before tenure and what you do after tenure. You know, before tenure, you're really supposed to keep your nose to the grindstone and churn out journal articles, especially because, you know, your department needs the articles in order to impress the university bureaucracy as a whole with the idea that its judgment is good. Afterwards, you have considerably more freedom to write books, to work for the government, to make public intellectual interventions, go on blue sky research programs that may well not turn out in the long run.
Well, there are a couple of things I'm curious about, and I guess the big one is, what was the reaction of your colleagues like when they started to discover that you were writing for an online audience? And I will ask, I should actually preface this by saying, so this is the late 90s. Are you on Typepad at this point? Are you writing in HTML on your personal page?
We're still handcrafting HTML at this stage. We're still handcrafting HTML. I mean, I think the overwhelming view was that, you know, public intellectual stuff is good. Working paper like stuff is good. It's a weird thing to do, but it's not a harmful thing to do, you know, and you have tenure. So, you know, when you have tenure and if you're satisfied with the fact that you're taking on a lot of variance here, you know, the fact that you have tenure gives you great optionality. You know, there's virtually no downside and there is a huge upside and some people should be doing this.
Now, when you were handcrafting your website, I remember doing some of that in the late 90s. Nobody read it, but I was, you know, in grad school and all that stuff. Were you organizing your website in what we now call blog format? Was it chronologically sequential, or were you putting up sort of, were you putting up thoughts on different things that could be accessed from a central hub and index page? What did this look like?
It was much more. It was much more an index page, and then an index page with sub-index pages. And, you know, journal articles, working papers, you know, op-ed drafts. Then in an attempt to get me to actually work on it, I would have a thought of the week and a graph of the week. And then, you know, the weblogging software industry appeared. And I fell into the movable type branch of that. And that then constrains your... makes a lot of things easy, but also makes a lot of things hard. And you get into the daily or the semi-daily or the weekly flow state where there is something at the top of the weblog and other things get pushed off. You know, and as Ezra Klein likes to say, this is very, very good at generating the flow, but this is absolutely awful in organizing the stock of things you've written in any useful or accessible way. And indeed, that's still a problem that we have not solved, that there is an awful lot of hidden submerged stock in the weblogosphere that was, that really ought to be surfaced on a much more easy level and scale, you know, but that is not.
That's interesting, right? Because I think that actually that much of the same happens now with podcasts, right? You know, sort of the old blogosphere is largely gone, but with podcasts, right, there's a ton of stuff that is intensely interesting, but if it was a month ago, then it's almost invisible unless you do a serious search for it. It's interesting how that... So, I mean, this is fascinating conversation because it almost feels like, you know, this is the... And I had an HTML website too. You know, this is the chiseled in stone era of the blogosphere. And then we get to the wood and eventually the printing press and so forth. At what point do you remember feeling like, you know, you were simply not just out there writing as an individual, but you were, because when you start writing, there is no blogosphere, right? There is no community of people. In the sense that we understood the community of the blogosphere. I mean, at what point do you start following people like Mickey Kouse, like Glenn Reynolds, other people who are early adopters who are doing similar things to this, and then start bouncing ideas off of this new community of people?
I think the crystallization for the community, or at least for my engagement in the community, it really came when the Bush administration went insane after September 11th and decided to ignore the fact that there are profound distinctions between Shia and Sunni within the Islamic world, and saying that really Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein are two heads of the same Hydra monster, rather than, you know, the dual containment strategy in the Middle East that the United States had followed ever since, well, you know, ever since Ronald Reagan, right? That we do not like Saddam Hussein, we do not like the Ayatollah Khomeini and his successors. Rather, fortunately for us, they hate each other more than they hate us, you know. And while it's grossly immoral to encourage them to war and threaten on each other, it is by and large a good thing for the great power interests of the United States, narrowly construed, for that to happen, even if not of hopes for a global utopian Kantian peace. But that was where the U.S. was until September 11th, 2001. And immediately afterwards, there's this shift, right? That the Bush administration likes every individual Muslim, especially their partners and friends associated with the Carlyle Group and with the House of Saud and of As-Saba. But, you know, the Islamic terrorist Hydra is a single unified thing that we are going to, as Tom Friedman once said, you know, pick up some shitty little country and throw it against the wall. And, you know, that, and I'm not crazy to think this is crazy, am I? And then finding other people also writing on the internet saying, I'm not crazy to think this is crazy, am I? You know, that was very much, I think, a community forming event. And after that, these became people who I would be interested in talking from and hearing from, if not every day, every week. Kind of semi-colleagues, but semi-colleagues in a different sense than my colleagues down the hall or my colleagues in the NBER Monetary Economics and American, right, you know, and development of the American economy groups.
John, if I can, I want to follow up here, right, because we have heard from some people, and I think people make the argument that September 11th is an inflection point that generates the blogosphere. The war on Iraq, the decision to go to war against Iraq, is the point at which, the inflection point at which Blogistan is divided into East Blogistan and right and West Blogistan, right, with the left
yes.
bloggers. And,
yes.
And I mean, with the war being sort of the central key divisor there, you obviously fell onto one side, but also you, yeah. it feels like you're sort of uneasily on that side sometimes, right? Because of your economics professional type stuff. Or do you not get that sense? Did you think of yourself as having a home in left Blogistan?
I thought of myself as having a home on the left Blogistan, right? That is as perhaps the most, say one of the people who was interested that the economic policies that left Blogistan proposed, you know, actually have a good chance of working, which means that you have to be a left neoliberal to accept and understand that markets are an extremely powerful social institution for crowdsourcing solutions to all kinds of problems. Because if you manage to get the prices right and control the externalities, you then have immediately solved the problem of pushing decision-making out to the periphery where the information is, and also incentivizing the people at the periphery to actually act in the general interest. And those are two problems that are utterly insolvable for bureaucratic or charismatic modes of organization, as at least those were traditionally conceptualized by left-wing intellectuals in, you know, the North Atlantic for the past 200 years. What's your view? What's your view of that? You know, that I know I was very surprised come September 12th. You know, that back before September 11th, you know, there had been Richard Clark, and he'd had fun being, you know, Richard Clark gets to be deputy president for counterterrorism, right? Chairing NEC meeting or NSC meetings with Clinton backing him on counterterrorism, and has an enormous amount of fun and does a lot of good things in the last 2 years of the Clinton administration. Condi Rice comes in and keeps him as, you know, director for counterterrorism. And he promptly wants to still be deputy president. So he makes all kinds of alliances with Tenet and others and goes around her back and tries at every stage to highlight this particular source of threat. And, you know, Cheney and Rice's response is, what the fuck are you doing? You know, no minor desk director at the NEC is going to go behind us and short circuit our priorities. You know, we are going to shut you down and throw you against the wall. And then on September 11th, it turns out that Richard Clark was, at least ex post, frighteningly, completely and totally right. And yet the response of the Bush administration is, oops, we're sorry. Here's your deputy president for counterterrorism slot back. It was instead very much, how dare you be right? We are going to double down and we are going to interpret what 9/11 as demonstrating that the extraordinary danger of state level threats from Iraq and Iran as sources of terrorism, and Libya and others too. And so we are going to embark on a strategy which winds up greatly easing the life of the terrorist supporters in Iran by removing their major obstacle toward Middle Eastern hegemony over at least the Arab world. You know, that... So, I mean, that the Bush administration was embarked on a path that seemed of insanity was very clear to me within a month after, you know, September 11th. So it wasn't the actual invasion that was the dividing point. It was, you know, what do they think they are doing?
So that's interesting. Like, and it's also interesting to me that a ton of the people who were on the right side, not the correct side, but were on the right side, yes, of that divide way back when, actually right now are doing things like talking up their restrainer cred, right? Sort of, it's kind of the shift that Tucker Carlson has made from being a serious war hawk then to now decrying, yes, any kind of international intervention. Sohab Amari, right, others. Who, and I don't know where the blogospheric specific people are. Like, I haven't read Glenn Reynolds in a long time, so I don't know what he's saying right now about like Ukraine or anything like that. But it is interesting that like that group of people who were serious neocon backers in the day are now very vocal right-wing restrainer types.
Well, but in some sense, what we've seen is, I mean, some of this is opportunism and it's other types of things, yeah, so you have to discount that. But ideologically, I think Trump has been a great sorting mechanism between people who were neoconservative for, as you know, Wilsonians with teeth, right? To paraphrase, right, John Mearsheimer, and people who are neoconservative who understood the divide as being ethno-civilizational character. Mm-hmm. So the people who had a kind of, were more inclined towards Islam as the enemy, they've all gone to the restraint camp in part because of their weird relationship to Russia and their real views in Russia, while the people who we would have, you know, who were neocons really have by and large broken with the Republican Party, it seems like. So, I mean, I think that's kind of comprehensible. What I think is interesting to me is how this, does this map, this kind of stuff map on at all to the way that the blogosphere looked at the time between September 11th and the invasion of Iraq. I was a consumer then, but my sense was that September 11th itself was a source of enormous fluidity.
Yes.
And that you had people who were, became very hard to classify ideologically to their responses to September 11th. And it was sort of interesting. I think to me as a consumer, it was interesting. It was also a little bit hard to follow. What was your sense of how September 11th, let's run up through the decision to, when it starts being clear we're going to invade Iraq too, how did that kind of affect your sense of the contours of your community? You said that it was expanding it to a large degree.
Yeah,
that, you know, you're finding like-minded people, but...
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of, Fred, lots of people who assure me that I'm not crazy. And sometimes a bunch of them have interesting things to say about my main day job, because, you know, the problem is always to find someone very smart and knowledgeable who does not think like you. Right. Because you already know what the people who think like you and are smart and knowledgeable think, hopefully. And the people who are think differently from you within your discipline, well, you've met them before and you've decided they're not terribly smart or not terribly knowledgeable, or they would think like you do. But someone with whom you have, who has a different disciplinary background, so you don't know exactly where they're coming from and who you have this form of agreement on one side, is a tremendous source of, you know, inspiration and ideas. Not just on, you know, war blogging or anti-war blogging, but on helping you think through other questions as well.
Now, you mentioned earlier when Rob asked you how you saw in the ideological makeup of the blogosphere at the time. I don't like the term blogosphere, so I reflexively say blogsphere. Which makes me an outlier, I realize, but I'll do my best. So you mentioned that you sort of felt thought of yourself as being clearly on the left economically, even though now, obviously, a lot of the people who self-identify as left who are active in social media would identify you as an evil neoliberal shill, et cetera, et cetera. At the time, though, I didn't have the impression that economics were a major source of division within the left political blogosphere. Did you ever get into fights with people or disagreements with people that were substantial in those years that we're talking about over economic
issues?
There
are fights over trade. There are two flashpoints, right? There was the trade flashpoint. And then also there was the, I would call it the financial regulation flashpoint. The question about whether we should be encouraging new modes of financial experimentation because the Federal Reserve had the power to keep it from having any systemic consequences and causing a large recession should something go wrong in finance. And there were those who wanted finance much more tightly regulated. But, you know, except for the real Republican shills, everyone was, you know, wanting very much to have, you know, the high-tech productivity boom continue and wanting very much to make very active interventions to both pre-distribute and redistribute wealth to reverse the great rise in income and wealth inequality that was then going up. So it's always a question of proper means and what means will be effective rather than a real divide, which was, I think, limited to those two areas. That is, you know, free traders versus, you know, protectionists on the one side and, you know, I suppose, Alan Greenspan versus Ned Gramlich on the other.
I'm going to get back to the technical side here just briefly. So you started off on, you started off HTML, then you moved to movable type. Like how many different platforms?
Which was buggy.
Yeah, well.
Which was buggy. And then jumped from movable type to TypePad when they said for $200 a year, we'll do your back end, which was quite good. And then 2 years ago, jumped from TypePad to Substack solely because it seemed that getting into people's email inboxes was actually worth a lot in these days for reasons I don't understand. And because they promised they were going to pursue a new set of better discovery tools and that their business model was going to actively work against clickbait as opposed to simply being neutral to clickbait. And so that seemed to be a movement that was worth joining, given the degeneration of so much else into clickbait.
Right. So I want to come back to Substack, but possibly towards the end. What half the blogosphere story is about bloggers and the other half is about commenters. And I don't remember on like sort of the evolution of your blog, certainly not at the HTML stage. I'm sure you didn't have commenters, right? At some point, did you have commenters and what kind of relationship did you have with them? Because that's the only reason LGM still exists, that we, the way we talk about it is we still have commenters.
Yeah, I did. I always envied you and I always envied Crooked Timber, you know, your commenters, that you seem to have done a wonderful job of nurturing and engaging and continuing a community of commenters. So there's a third one as well, Unfogged, right? That Unfogged, that Crooked Timber and Lawyers, Guns and Money were what I thought comment section should be and were remarkably and remarkably successful. I never figured out how to do that. You know, I got very good individual comments from individuals, but you know, it never formed a community of anything like the kind that you managed to form and nurture and moderate somehow. You know, and I always wondered, should I be doing more to create that? But also, you know, ars longa in vita brevis, you know, the weblog was taking up too much of my time. In general, for me to want to expand my engagement in it further.
I think it's the ones that you mentioned, and I would add to this Balloon Juice, which is sort of renowned.
Yeah, definitely Balloon Juice. Balloon Juice is wonderful.
I think with the major exception being Eschaton, which most of what Eschaton is now is just commenting. almost all the good commenting spheres are community blogs, right? They're groups of people. Yes. And so
yes.
instead of
yes.
having to yes. rely just on you to engage with the commenters, you can rely right. on a whole group right. of people, right? And so Crooked Timber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I always thought of mm-hmm. your blog as being one model of commenting, which I rather liked, although it wasn't as expansive as something yeah. like Lawyers, Guns, and Money. So you have the Lawyers, Guns, and Money unfogged Blue and Juice model, which is very much like an old Usenet bulletin board, or now
yes.
like a Reddit
yes, yes.
or subreddit, I guess, is what the, mm-hmm. the youngins would know. Mm-hmm. And your model always seemed to be more bilateral, you know, that somebody would come in, they'd have some questions or some comments, and you'd have a brief discussion with them.
Yeah.
And that's always seemed yeah. like a fine, mm-hmm. actually fairly nice way for an academic blog written by an academic to engage with an audience, even though mm-hmm. it didn't have that necessarily self-propelled vitality of a bulletin, you know, a blog as mm-hmm. bulletin board.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
Which leads me to a question that I really want to ask you. You have a very distinctive voice in your writing for first blogging and now for Substack, which reads pretty much exactly like your blog always did. And I'm curious whether that was something that you thought about a lot, whether it was organic, whether you looked at other bloggers and thought about what you liked about what they were doing or not doing. You know, how did that evolve?
It seems to be organic. And I'm not sure whether it's unfiltered or to some degree a reaction against the filtering that more academic prose imposes on things. I've thought about trying to write things in different voice, and I've always come back to the conclusion that that would be really hard, and that the voice I have seems to be serviceable and seems to work or seems to work for enough people. You know, that it annoys some and, you know, pleases and interests others, which is why right now I'm very interested in, you know, Noah Smith's observation in his review of my forthcoming book that, you know, that's an expedition into the DeLongiverse. And you have to figure out whether you like being in the DeLongiverse or not. And so I'm going to be harassing him on Twitter for the next several days, asking him to specify more about just what he sees that the Longiverse as being, because I see it only from the inside.
I mean, that raises another question, which is very specific to academic blogging, but it's one that we've heard different answers to, and that I think is interesting, which is how would you characterize the relationship between your blogging and your more strictly academic or professional writing? How did that relationship develop? What is that? Did you find that you took certain things away from blogging, or that you were trying to, you know, that you were simply code shifting? How did that work for you? I mean, I know we've had people, for example, for whom the academic blogging clearly, as you say, for your forthcoming book, inflected mm-hmm. the way that they talked and presented. And we have people for whom it seems to have been really a quite distinct enterprise.
I have to say, I don't really know. This raises a very interesting question, and that I should go back through this book coming out on September 6th and then my last two books and actually seriously think about how are these different precisely because I spent time being a web blogger, as opposed to if I'd spent time doing anything else. And I'd like to defer that until a return visit, you know, sometime in a year or so, when I want to beg you to have me on to talk about the reception that my book turns out to have had.
No, that's a really interesting point, Dan. I mean, instead of thinking about it, I've been straightforward. My first book, the Air Force book, was inspired straightforwardly by a comment mm-hmm. from Matt Iglesias. Like, I sat down and had lunch with Matt Iglesias. He says, you should write a book on why the Air Force should be abolished. And it's like, okay, I'll go ahead and do that.
Yes, okay. Yes.
But it does okay. seem to be different with, I think it's different even with different bloggers within the LGM community, right? We have a lot of academic bloggers within the LGM community. I think there's mm-hmm. variance on that point, even with, I think Scott's right. Sort of professional work and his blogospheric work is in a lot of ways a lot more linked even than mine. And of course, the law school people right. are always different. So this may be a leap ahead, but two questions bound sort of in the same one question. And the second one, the latter half of this is going to be big. So question one is, what do you think of, where would you identify as like sort of the major inflection points where the blogosphere and the project of blogging changed? And second, we ask this of everybody who does this, and sometimes they say, well, it didn't, and other times it, but when and why did the blogosphere die?
The standard view is that Facebook was much better at communicating with friends and family. And then at, you know, hacking your brain so that your eyeballs are glued to the screen and you are terrified and they can sell you fake diabetes cures, overpriced gold funds, and dubious crypto assets.
Hey, fortune that, favors the bold, Brad.
You know, YouTube turned out to be much better at, you know, people who didn't have a prose voice or didn't, the people who were neither had a prose voice in writing already established, or who did not read easily. In the sense of being able to read something and then from those black marks in a page, spinning up a subterranean instantiation of the mind that had written those words and then engaging it in their mind's eye with dialogue and debate. And so if you aren't a real print junkie, if you're a more a normal visual thinking person, YouTube is better in lots of ways. Instagram was better for printing, for putting up photographs of things, and so forth. And of course, Twitter was much better for the snark and the peace occasion. And so the thing split out with different pieces going in different ways. And in the process, we lost a lot of economies of scale and scope. And so we produced a lot of different sub-blogospheres, each of which is much, much larger than the blogosphere was, but each of which, precisely because it's specialized in various ways, misses a lot of the synergies and a lot of the accidental positive discovery features that we had before. And then, of course, Twitter attains critical mass, becomes dominant, and you know, is a hellscape that turns saints into good people into, you know, neutral people into assholes, and assholes into flaming Nazis. And, you know, is best avoided unless you have a very, very strong ability to keep your fingers off the keyboard on Twitter. Either to read or to write or to respond. And so it was that, you know, technological shift away from a integrated but print and prose-centered version of the public sphere that I think has produced the rather weird world we have today, in which there are a bunch of old fogey dinosaurs who continue to blog, but you know, our influence really comes mostly from the fact that people who read us then snark at us on Twitter.
I think what's interesting and distinctive about your answer from the ones we've had, I mean, people have talked about Twitter as being really deadly. People have talked about the collapse of Google, the end of Google Reader and the problem of RSS feeds. But you're actually talking about a way in which...
And so, Substack is back, essentially, as RSS feeds come again in a different guise. Yes.
So that is the natural question, which is that a lot of people have looked at the rise of Substack and said, this looks a lot like blogging, where it's delivered to your email box so you don't have to use some other mechanism. Do you think that that's right? Do you think there's something distinctive about the platform?
I would say it's too early. It's too early days to know. I would say they definitely want to move to the long essay kind of once a week or at most once a day version of blogging, as opposed to multiple things a day, end of the blogosphere that was. You know, that it distinctly seems uncool to mail out a Substack newsletter more than once every 2 days.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that would make that would make a group blog like LGM completely untenable on Substack.
Well, or it would say, or you would be split into five.
Right.
Well, but then and you can it would click cease on to be a group which blog. Of these five authors do you want to assume?
Right. Or you would do what people have suggested, although we don't have any content for me to pimp, but that you write a daily summary or weekly summary of what's been on the blog.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, probably the way to go for Lawyers, Guns, and Money, which we haven't discussed at all. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there's an expectation that you're going to sit down and read the newsletter that shows up in your email inbox, even if it does have links in it, as opposed to the blog, which is that you're going to read until you find an interesting link that looks more interesting than reading the next paragraph and then jump off and maybe never return.
One last question. I'm sure Dan may have some more questions, but one last question on the blogospheric specific part of this. What of your blogospheric history still exists and is findable by people in something that is not Internet Archive, right? What is still out there? People can go and look it up.
Oh, the entire TypePad, thing since 2005 is out there and is live. The Ethernet jack in my office died during the plague years, and I haven't yet gotten the people to fix it. And when they do, it'll plug back in the kind of old laptop that has the pre-2005 archives on it, and those will be live again as well. So then it'll be everything back into the day in 1996, I think, when I took Paul Mendy's advice and put up my first HTML page. But at the moment, it's only stuff since 2005 because, you know, plague, flaky internet or flaky Ethernet and so forth.
It's interesting. There's a lot of variance in how people feel about their archives. It's interesting that Iglesias, for example, just doesn't give a damn. He just doesn't care about you know, keeping the stuff up from 2002 or something like that. Whereas other people, you know, they sort of they mm-hmm. treasure the existence of this archive.
Yeah. Well, he kept jumping from publication to publication. And never had direct property rights over it. And then, you know, these small magazines are extremely bad at dealing with their own archives. Even when they were just print small magazines, they were very bad at dealing with their archives. But yeah, this is something I should give a higher priority to this summer. Right? Because right now, the only place where it's really live is on its little partition on the hard disk in front of me. Or it's an all at archive.org, which is close to good enough.
So I'm really anxious to hear about your book, but I'm afraid I do have one more question, which is, so I think of the people who I thought, if I go back and I think about the people who I thought had really important blogs in the old blogosphere because they were well-read or they were central nodes or frankly just because they had really good content, most of those people, even people who are in academic positions, professionalized in some way. They went and wrote for publications or for think tanks that established blogs and thinking about Lawfare or Just Security or places like that. I don't think, recall you ever jumping ship to that kind of a gig. Was that something that you thought about, that you had the opportunity to, or was it just not something you were interested in doing?
Well, you know, I was already a Berkeley professor, right? I was already sitting in the middle of what was not necessarily the highest ranked, but certainly the best economics department in the world. You know, that kind of all of the intellectual bets that we have made over the past 25 years, you know, whether on the credibility revolution in labor economics and public finance, whether behavioral finance, whether behavioral economics, whether modern Keynesian macro, all of those have come in and have come in as jackpots. Yeah. That, you know, if for any time over the since I kind of got here in 1995, if you wanted to understand anything about the economy, you would have been much better. You would have had much more likely chance of actually getting someone who would say what was right if you came here to Berkeley and wandered around on the fifth and sixth floor of Evans than if you went anywhere else in the world. You know, so I was lucky enough to fall into kind of what was, from my opinion, the best possible place. And from there, it's really, you know, not at all clear how one would go about professionalizing it, right? That, you know, what could I do that was more attractive to me given, you know, who I was and given how families tend to get very, very sticky once the children start going to school.
Okay, so we've got to ask you about your book, which I think looks really exciting. And I've been following your Substack emails, and you've been talking about different kinds of elevator pitches. So why don't you, can you give us your elevator pitch, your current best elevator pitch?
All right. Well, the first part of it is BIT period LY / 3P capital P. 3 capital K, small r, small k. That's the bit.ly URL for the ordering page, and pre-orders matter. Pre-orders matter a lot. All right, Slouching Towards Utopia is an economic history of the long 20th century, which I define as 1870 to 2010. And the long 20th century was the very first in which history was primarily economic, right? With the economy not kind of the painted scene backdrop against which history takes place. You know, before 1870, you know, humanity had thought that the big problem was it could not bake a big enough pie given limited technology and natural resources relative to population. Human production could not be large enough for everyone to have enough. And so those who did have enough had it by figuring out a way to take a large chunk of what others produced away from them. And most of history involved the struggles, either to get enough for yourself or to justify to yourself why you are one of the people who should have enough. And in the 20th century, that constraint fell away. You know, we could bake a large enough economic pie. But better technology did not help solve the problems of slicing the pie equitably or of tasting the pie. As of today, having enough remains out of reach for most of humanity, even though there's no necessity for that. And those with enough have a hard time properly tasting it. You know, you look around and many or most of our fellows do not seem healthy, happy, secure, safe, or wise. Thus, only when the political economic order was the post-World War II North Atlantic social democratic shotgun marriage of Friedrich von Hayek to Karl Polanyi, a marriage in some sense blessed by John Maynard Keynes's focus on full employment, could we even slouch towards utopia. But that marriage itself failed its own sustainability tests when it ran into the buzzsaw of the neoliberal challenge of the 1980s. The explosion of our science and technological competence, and then our application of it to, you know, production via full globalization, the modern corporation, and the industrial research lab, all of which burst upon the world in 1870, that ought to have made, you know, prosperity and indeed utopia our birthright. Yet we have, in many respects, you know, sold it for thin red lentil stew. Well, why have we failed so catastrophically at equitably slicing and then properly tasting the large economic pie we built? Well, you know, Friedrich von Hayek was the one who most keen-sightedly observed that the market economy is tremendously effective at crowdsourcing solutions. And Hayek drew from this the conclusion that the market giveth, the market taketh away, blessed be the name of the market. We dare not interfere with this thing because it can produce prosperity for all, or at least for most, and attempting to monkey with it to go further runs the risk of destroying its ability to do its job. You know, but humans disagreed. You know, as genius Carl Polanyi saw, humans needed much more rights than property rights, expected property rights. And, you know, the market's treating the only rights that mattered as property rights and treating those whom society saw as unequals as equals unequally and treating unequals equally. You know, that has brought us social explosion after social explosion with mammoth political and genocidal consequences. You know, not blessed be the name of the market, but rather the market was made for man, not man for the market, was required if humanity was to even slouch towards the utopia that we ought to have already grasped with our technology. You know, but how? We are still in the position John Maynard Keynes thought we were back in 1924 when he wrote, quote, "We lack more than usual a coherent scheme of progress, a tangible idea. It is not necessary to debate the subtleties of what justifies a man in promoting his gospel by force, for no one has a gospel. The next move must be with the head." That's a long elevator ride.
So one of the reasons that I'm so intensely interested in this is that I have been slow motion reading Vaclav Smil's Creating the 20th Century.
Oh, yes.
And of course, he's talking from 1870 to 1914, right? Yes. Which is only part of the story you're telling, but still, it seems like it seems very much like part of the same story. And honestly, from one of the reasons,
it is, and a bunch after 1914, a bunch of the technologies he has identified and he focuses on, then play themselves out. You know, not just in terms of deepening their application and expanding within the North Atlantic, but of spreading out to the rest of the world. You know, so it is the kind of same second industrial revolution as absolutely crucial story that I'm telling, but I'm doing the political economy side. He's doing the science technology side. In between, there's a Schumpeterian technology industrial finance book.
Well,
to be
from my point of view, from the security studies side, it's an intensely interesting argument, right? Because it explains how transformative the military doctrines and structures and technologies from the Civil War to World War One, which is an utter and complete transformation, and which we only sort of imperfectly engage in from the on the security studies side. But this is a, you know, it's absolutely critical. It's an absolutely critical lens for looking at revolutions in military.
Yes, although it could have been. If John Bell Hood had not, against all logic and reason, managed to take that hill in the Seven Days Battle, maybe people would have learned in 1862 what they actually only learned in 1915, to the extent that rushing people on top of a hill who had any time to dig in and have a rifle.
Well, I mean, yes and no,
insane.
Right? Because and people pointed this out to me at the War College. No? You take a picture of Gettysburg and you superimpose it with World War One technology, and it's like, all right, so everybody in this picture dies because of artillery that is fired from off screen, right? Yeah, which is exactly what's happening in Ukraine right now, right? And so we are still in the grip of World War One, as I keep saying. But there is a profound transformation.
Well, if you can be seen, you die, right? And furthermore, even if you can't be seen, if you fire too much from the same position, you die. And so it's always about how do you suppress fire while they move and could be seen, and then how do you fire from where you're unseen, and how do you then bug out before they get you? And all of this in a social practice where the interest is ultimately getting the local policeman to behave the way you want the local policeman to behave. I confess, I do not understand 21st century war or what it will be like.
All right. Well, Brad, this has been enormously productive, and I want to thank you so much for hanging out with us on this afternoon.
You are welcome. It's been an extraordinary pleasure for me, too, and it does give me my ability to thank you all for the enormous influence you've had on my thought and all that you have taught me over the past 2.5 decades, that, you know, we all find ourselves in positions in which the people who have been big influences on us, because we have spent a lot of time arguing with them in the shower, but we're not arguing with them. We're arguing over the subterranean instantiations of their minds that we have spun up and run on our own wetware, based on the marks they made in Page, you know, that I feel I know you all very well and have had a great many very good conversations with you, even though that's totally false. And I'd like to acknowledge that. You've taught me a huge amount.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on and for helping to not just, I think, giving us a lot of interesting things to think about and getting a chance to, you know, tell us what your book's about, but also for contributing to our effort to build an oral history of this strange, wonderful, exciting period from the early 2000s to what did we decide the end of the blogosphere was now? What is the...
I think the most common answer has been what you suggested, which is the end of Google Reader, that it's just a convenient, and not sort of assigning a causation, but it's a convenient moment to say. And so I want to say that's 2014, something along those lines. But we should find that date, right? So we can say that is the date that it died, even if that's an invincible proposition. So,
Well, anyway, so thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you so much. And thank our listeners and readers. And Brad, we look forward to having you on again once we've read your book and can talk about it in greater detail.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,